I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Ned Hill, who is a professor of public affairs and city and regional planning now at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at OSU, and before that was for a long time at Cleveland State University in the Levin College of Urban Affairs. So without further ado, I'll introduce Dr. Hill.
Just a warning for those of you that have their back to me, this thing at times is going to look like a movie, so if you want to move off to an open table or turn around, that's fine. That's great. So first, as everyone else does and has been doing to you for 3 days, I want to add my congratulations to joining the legislature and for continuing careers of public service. This is what happens in this town is important to everybody in the state. And we think of Ohio as a state. If we were Europe, Ohio would be a nation. We're about, if you want to figure out what we're equivalent to, we're kind of Belgium without the food fight between the French speakers and the Dutch speakers. And I also want to thank the Legislative Service Commission for bringing me back. They have a tolerance, and I think that they brought me back because they wanted to lower the food bill, knowing that an economist at lunch usually doesn't work well. So what I'm going to do today is, in my presentation, I'm going to cover a fair amount of ground. First, I'm going to go through and give you a quick introduction to Ohio, the economy of Ohio. Then I'm going to roll into and give an overview of the U.S. macroeconomy to focus what's going on, because a lot of what happens nationally rolls down and affects us. Third section is I'm going to start the first of the policy puzzles. And that is called Where Have All the Workers Gone? Policy Puzzle 2 is going to talk about trade, which is a very dangerous thing to talk about. But data and facts sometimes help. There's a difference between truth and truthiness, as Colbert has told us. So I figured I'd deal with some data there. The fifth section will deal with the issue of manufacturing and jobs. And then a little bit on electricity generation and re-regulation. And if time permits, the puzzle that's starting to affect us when it comes to home ownership. So it's a broad tour, but I am here to help aim one more fire hose at you as you go about doing your business here. And it's also fascinating. So what's the state of Ohio's economy? The Ohio's economy is actually doing moderately well or modestly well. There is steady, slow growth, but as we've seen from the reactions from the elections, there's a lot of nervousness and unease out there. What's happened in Ohio, as it's happened in large parts of the United States, is the old social contract, particularly for unskilled workers or semi-skilled workers, and society's just been torn up. And it hasn't been replaced. And a whole bunch of people that worked really hard and play the game by the rules, I think the technical term is honked off. And that's where the nervousness comes from. The old trade of Ohio, even for rural Ohio, was go forth, work for a very big company. The big company will employ you for the rest of your life. You have a guaranteed pension. Workers, management, and stockholders will squabble as to how to break up the earnings from the company itself. But essentially, the contract was, if you play the game by the rules, stick it out for 30 years, you're set. And I have been hearing comments. I wasn't at this meeting. There was a public hearing in Columbiana County 2 years ago where three different people basically made the same statement to the House committee. And it said, I expect, as a high school dropout in Ohio, to be able to afford a used truck, own my own home, and be able to take a vacation. That isn't there anymore. And people are mad. And the other thing that's really hard about this is there is no silver bullet. There's no easy answer. And the same way I refer to the city of Cleveland, my former residence, as an overnight sensation 40 years in the making, we have to realize to fix this problem or these sets of problems is going to take a hell of a long time. And it means we need a very strong compass as we're doing it. So I think about the promise of jobs and progress. I keep on going back to Jim Rhodes. And what Jim Rhodes, when he was campaigning, said, promise jobs, make progress, you get elected. And that's what President-elect Trump did. He promised jobs, he promised progress. If you look at these two maps, this kind of builds on what John presented earlier. The map that's in blue and burgundy is the unemployment rate in the counties in September of 2016. And the other map comes from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And that is a map of the difference in returns for between Romney and Trump. You'll notice that there's a lot of overlap between that. If you put in John's cultural map on top of this, you get a very good idea of what's going on. In fact, some of us didn't expect Trump to win. We surely didn't expect the margins that he won by. But we knew that the Democratic Party nationally didn't have a clue as to what was going on in Ohio because you just didn't travel the state. If you took the road, back roads from Mount Vernon to come to Columbus, it was the handwritten signs in favor of Trump and looking for change that was so impressive. That what we really had was a primal scream. So it has a lot to do with it. The other two things that are taking place is J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, is now taking our state by storm. And this is a book of written by J.D. Vance, trying to make sense out of his own life, second-generation kid, grandparents moved out of Kentucky, lived in Middletown, and he was trying to make sense of the dysfunction in his own family and found out that a lot of what was going on in his family was no different what was going on with inner-city African-American families, and he was really came to the conclusion that there are cultural issues involved that are important. Vance is still arguing about this. He's still trying to figure it out. But I think that his observations on the role of culture and the role of family are going to be something that's going to bridge divides that we haven't seen in this state. I know my students are paying more attention to it. The other companion piece is John Bagala's piece on big city problems in Ohio's small towns that came out in time for the Impact Ohio Conference, loaded with data and really going at the same set of pathologies that seem to be coming out of what's happening in the low-wage portion of the workforce is causing a change in Ohio. I spend a lot of time talking about Ohio's courthouse square towns. This is the fabric of the state. This is what kept the state together. And it was a combination of big cities with big factories and these courthouse towns with a plant at either end of Main Street or close by the river or by a railroad track. Those plants largely, frequently, are still there. The ones that disappeared 20 years ago. But they're very different plants hiring different people with different wages. And so we're going to have to pay attention to it. And you're going to hear, as your term progresses, both of Vance's work and Bagala's work going forward. Because this is the issue we have, is how do we keep the fabric of the state together? And what's the role of personal responsibility? What's the role of public policy? And what is the role of economic development? And frankly, I don't have the answers. If you press me hard enough, I'll make them up, but I'll try to be honest about it. Here's, to me, is one of the most stunning pieces of information that we put together to get ready for you. The list of the top 10 largest employers in the state of Ohio in 1995. Those that are in red are no longer in the top 10 list. Those that are in light blue still are in the top 10 list, and they're in retail. That's Kroger and Walmart. And Bank One, Finance, they're still in the list. They're now called J.P. Morgan Chase. Look at 2016. Those in green, dark green, are healthcare institutions. I don't know what to call Ohio State, because those numbers contain both the educational mission and the healthcare complex. You've got Wright Pat joining us. So the hospitals are Ohio Health, University Hospitals in Cleveland, Mercy Health, and then the Cleveland Clinic. And then the other people, organizations that joined were Wright Pat, Ohio State University. The issue with those big employers in 2016, Cleveland Clinic, Walmart, and Kroger, is there's a lot of low-skilled jobs in those workforces. Cleveland Clinic at least has a job ladder. Even though someone's an orderly, I guarantee you will not become a brain surgeon, but there's ways to advance. In Walmart and Kroger, they're very different work environments. And I expect that going forward, we may see Amazon joining that list in the not-too-distant future. That's the challenge. We don't want to say we don't want these employers, but we have to also understand what the terms of employment are. So let me first set the scene by talking about the macroeconomy. This is the 12-month growth rate in real GDP. And by the way, these slides are going to be available on tape. They're going to be available electronically through the website. And if any of you want paper copies, let us know, and we'll make certain we get to them. This is the 12-month growth rate in gross domestic product nationally from April 2007, about when the recession started, up to 2016. You'll notice that we've been bouncing around, and so the Federal Reserve Bank has been holding off increasing interest rates because of the slow, erratic notion of this recovery. In fact, you'll notice a red bar showing up in 2011. That's where Congress screwed up and we almost had a second recession because the stimulus package wasn't passed. And we saw three quarters of the metropolitan areas in the nation go into recession again in 2011. We had a second dip in large parts of the country. So the other point that I take, and this is a national point, is that Keynes he may be dead, but his ideas are alive, and we have to make certain we have adults in charge of running the macro economy. What's happened with the recovery? This is the net change in jobs from the month before the Great Recession started. The bottom gray area looks like kind of an outline of my grandmother's grand piano. No, we were poor. We didn't have a grand piano. Oh, that was the toy one that came into the house at Christmas. But the good thing is, since the recovery in jobs started, which it didn't start until late 2014, the nation's added 6.2 million jobs. So that's a good thing. And it's been, as we looked at it, oh, you'll see this in a second. This is the monthly jobs report. We've been adding, but it's been very spiky. So the solid black line is when you're above 200,000 jobs added a month. That's what the Fed and most analysts look for from the job report. Are you close to 200,000 jobs a month, and is it consistent? And you'll notice that each time we kind of went through and jobs came up, then it crashed down. Jobs came up, then it crashed down. And that is uncertainty in the economy. I've got buried in the back of the deck, you aren't going to see it, as to why those swings took place. And what you saw was consumer spending was very erratic, but the really big difference was business investment changed drastically. The quick return in 2011 is because of the revival of the auto industry and the opening up of the auto plants and the auto supply chain. That was nationally. And then it was like the spigot got turned off. And that's when we went back into the downturn at 2011, and then slowly coming back up from there as business confidence increased. So business investment, it's not consumer spending, seems to be driving the recovery. The scary thing is business investment for the past 18 months has been tailing off. I've been following the investment in capital goods and tooling, and that's been dropping. And there's some reasons for that I'll show you in a bit. So here's the first big policy puzzle. Where have all the workers gone? You've campaigned. You heard people asking for, I want a job. I want a better job. I'm willing to work more hours. You heard that door to door wherever you went. You heard it in public meetings. At the same time, what are you hearing from the employers? Can't find workers. Well, what they're really saying is, I can't find a worker who hasn't figured out how to pee in a cup right. And that's a major challenge. But we also don't have workers at the right skill level. And what's happened is the labor market for the semi-skilled and the unskilled has gone to hell in a handbasket, and it's not going to come back. And we just have to realize that. That's as bad news for people who culturally, I mean, the last remnant of blue-collar Ohio is this notion that high school is good enough. Well, I don't think everybody should go on for getting a BA. Don't tell the president I said this, president of the college, the university. But we do have to make certain that we reinforce those non-college-going careers that offer really good incomes, because that's where the labor shortage is, and you're hearing it. We do have other parts, I'm going to go through this policy puzzle, that show that we've got problems. I'm an economist. I think money can solve anything except the workforce. We've got sociological problems at work as well. So let's go through it. The blue line in this slide is the path of the unemployment rate, or it's the schematics for the new roller coaster at Sandusky. It's one or the other. If that's the path of the roller coaster and you want to get rid of kidney stones, sit in the last car, it'll crack the stone, you're all set, you're doing well. But the red line is what's concerned. That red line is the labor force participation rate. That's the number of people working or looking for work divided by the population. That's been steadily going downhill. Now, the decline is mostly demographic. We're getting older as population. The new cohorts coming into the labor market are smaller than those leaving the labor market. The other thing that happened with the Great Recession is so many people who at the start of the Great Recession were in their late 40s or early 50s have just retired from the labor force altogether. So that is of some worry. Alan Krueger just released a paper last week that he expects aging to continue to reduce the labor force participation rate by 0.2 or 0.3 percentage points, so 2 basis points or 3 basis points a year for the next decade. And that, so when you've got people at the national level promising you super high growth rates, it's not going to happen because the foundation of the growth rate is an increase in the labor force. If your labor force is getting smaller, what's going to happen with your growth rate? It's going to start to drop, which means that public policy in the United States has to start shifting away from just making the damn thing bigger to making it better and higher quality, because we have to use our people and find ways to invest in our people so that they're much smarter. That drop in the labor force participation rate over time, normally we would say that's a great thing for low-income workers because that's going to tighten up labor markets, which is going to increase wages. Well, here's the challenge. We now have a bifurcated labor market. So no matter how tight labor markets get, there's only so far the unskilled and the undereducated are going to be able to get to earn. Because at some point, if they get too expensive and they don't contribute to the revenues for their employers, the employer is going to go and automate. We have 70,000 people in Greater Columbus employed in the warehouse, transportation, logistics industry. They're upping wages. That's all good stuff. But through RFID and robots, a lot of those warehouses, if the prices get too high, are going to go lights out. We have 1.2 million people nationwide, I believe, driving trucks in this country. And a great place of labor shortage right now is over-the-road truck drivers. They're really screwing up on the peeing in a cup bit, and it's a tough job. Well, at some point, a lot of those jobs are going to be fully automated. You're going to have autonomous vehicles. And right now, truck driving is one of the best paying large number of blue-collar jobs for a semi-skilled American who can use a computer a little bit. And 10 years from now, that labor market's going to change substantially. So we have to make certain that we take everything that Paulo said and John Kerry said, seriously, because we are writing the social contract for the kids now that they're going to live with for the next 40 years. Here's the other thing that's really shocking. The green line is the inflation-adjusted it's a real increase in average hourly earnings in the United States. From 2008 to 2016, over 8 years, the real average hourly earnings increased by $1.12. That means that for large numbers of Americans, those that are unskilled and semi-skilled saw their real earnings drop, because this is counterbalanced by the increase at the high end of the skill gap. And the black line is the percent change in real earnings over time. This is national numbers. This is not Ohio numbers. But I believe that the trends will be similar in the state of Ohio. The good news is, in many ways, Ohio is outperforming the rest of the Midwest. That big fat red line or dark line that you're seeing, that is the unemployment rate in the state of Ohio. Throughout most of the Great Recession, particularly during the recovery starting in 2011 when the auto industry came back, our unemployment rates have been largely below that, the national average. The bright blue line, that's the unemployment rate for our surrounding competitor states. That includes Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. Yes, if we ever get in real trouble, we can always change our license plates to say, thank God for West Virginia. We always look good. I have a trip scheduled to West Virginia in about a week, so don't let this thing out for a while. Thank you. All right, but here's the other thing. Here's the labor force participation rate. So high good, low bad. Ohio has had the same decline in the labor force participation rate as the rest of the nation. But on the whole, we've been performing at about the national rate. We're outperforming all of our other states, the rest of the states in the region. So we have a labor force participation rate problem, but it's tougher in the other states. This is really is reflecting particularly what's going on in Pennsylvania and Michigan because of the size of their labor force. So we do have to worry about labor force participation. Well, here's the nub of the problem. This is where have the workers gone? This is the labor force participation rate for prime age males. Prime age males are those 25 to 54. They're the gut of the labor market. This has been declining consistently since this graph starts in 1955. The shaded areas are the recessions. Well, let's look at the labor force participation rate in this group. In 1955, this is when America was the only industrial power left in the world, 97.4% of private age men were working or were looking for work. In 2015, that 96.7 is not right. That's 86.7 are now working. I have to change on the slide. So over the time period that basically covers my life, we've seen this number increase by 10 full percentage points. That is stunning. The largest decrease took place from 2005 to 2015, where the labor force participation rate decreased by 7%. Now, what's happening? Now, remember, these are 25 to 54. So two things are going on at both ends of the spectrum. We have fewer people becoming 25 starting this year because the cohorts are getting smaller. Second, we've taken adolescence and we've extended it terrifically, so all of us have to worry about how we get the millennials out of our basements and out to work. This is really important. Damn, I mean, plus we do their laundry. Got to make it tougher for them to stay. I don't refer to the millennial generation anymore. I refer to them as the yo-yo generation because you put them out and they come right back. It's a tough thing. But the other major change is the increase in the number of people 45 and above that aren't working. Calm early retirements, calm discouraged workers, but these are serious issues. So let me make sure I get this right. Yeah, this is the labor force participation rate by education levels. Dropouts, only about 45% of prime age men who have less than a high school diploma are working or looking for work. That's tough. High school grads with no college, remember, numerically, that's the largest size, that's the largest number of people in this labor force. We've gone from 63% of this portion of the labor force in 2007 working or looking for work. It dropped 4.8 percentage points to 58.3%. You want to see where that primal scream that showed up in the election came from? Either people not voting or voting in saying, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore? That's where it's coming from. Even those with bachelor's degrees, that dropped by 4.2 percentage points. So there's something going on here that's fundamental. There's something going on here that we have to understand. So I did a little bit of looking. The President's Council of Economic Advisors has a very convincing report out that showed that the decline is largely concentrated by dropouts and high school graduates. We've seen that here. And it's been steeper among African-American men. That is the group, particularly high school graduates, African-American men, that are having the most difficulty in this labor force, labor market. The 2014 survey of families headed by men, 25 to 54, in the lowest third of the income distribution. So these are men running families in the bottom one-third of the income distribution. 33% worked less than half-time. 27% reported they were either ill or disabled. 22% reported that they could not find work. And 50% said that they weren't working because of school, family responsibilities, or catch this, they're retired. That is a challenge. Sawhill and Gary, Elizabeth Bell Sawhill and Gary Burtless did some work. And they found that the wages for those who graduated with a high school diploma since 1980 in inflation-adjusted terms dropped by 28%. Demand for low-skilled workers is falling faster than supply, causing wages to drop. And the Council of Economic Advisors estimated that the 1975 wages for those with a high school degree or less was 80% of that of a college graduate. In 2014, it was less than 60% of a college graduate. There are a couple things that are important to understand about this. The important thing is we can't change the labor market. We have to change the people in the labor market because of global forces. The other thing is that if we want to go back to the economy of the 1970s, remember that we will be poor and consumers will be paying more for their products. So we have to figure out how to work with the market rather than against it to make certain that we get the right set of social outcomes. Interesting enough, Gary Bertless, who on most issues, he's a friend of mine, he's somewhere to the left of Lenin, made the statement that disability roles have grown because benefits are now competitive with current wages. He's not saying that disability benefits have gone up so much, because they really haven't. It's just the alternative wages have gone down so much that the incentive to go to work has declined substantially. Now, the Council of Economic Advisors disagrees with this. They say that the increase in the rate payments for disability insurance has gone up a little, it nowhere matches what's taking place with the people who are qualifying for it. They're arguing for medical reasons. We also have to be very honest about the fact that when we look at the rates with the African-American population and other minority populations, that the impact of the increase in the prison populations from 2008 are now showing up in the numbers. Because we've got large numbers of relatively new entrants in the labor market who have felony records that are following them after the release. And if you've got a felony record, forget check the box, they're gonna find it sooner or later. It's gonna be very difficult to get a job, and unless we find a way to expunge, or getting people is happening in, Steve Hogue, what's the restaurant in Cleveland? Edwin's Restaurant in Cleveland? All right, which has doing a wonderful job of working with ex-felons, but that's one particular industry. Alan Krueger conducted a pain survey in October. Alan started this when he was head of research in the Department of Labor. The pain survey among prime-age men, 25 to 54, who are not in the labor force. The results here are stunning. 40% of these men reported their non-employment comes from pain, that pain prevents them to work in full-time jobs that they're qualified to hold. The previous survey showed that this is only true of 22% of the general population. 43.5% of those who report being in pain are not in the labor force. Some of this is work injury, some of it's opioid abuse, some of it's prescription abuse, so that's gonna fit into your next session. I will say this is not a moral problem, this is a medical problem, because if you look close enough, it's in all of our families. If it's not in all of our families, it's in all of our churches, it's in all of our social groups, and we do have to be very concerned about what's taking place. 47% of the group that was surveyed took paid medication the day before responding. That will include aspirin. 65% of this group, though, took prescription meds. That's 29% of the non-employed were taking prescription meds. 66% report having a disability. 35% received Social Security disability insurance. This is a crisis. Opioid abuse, pain prescriptions is now an economic development issue, along with having large parts of America not knowing how to pee in a cup right. I keep on going back to that because that's really important. I think if you're going to fund any research, if someone could put together a test that could see how active the ingredients of marijuana are during the time period which someone's actually working rather than over 35 days, that would be a good thing. Right now, we allow people to go get themselves completely blitzed and hammered over the weekend and show up to work on Monday as long as they don't have the DTs and they can go to work because the negative effect of alcohol is out of their system. If someone goes and has a little reefer and gets stoned, gets arguably a little less messed up, but that THC stays in hair follicles for 32, 35. The tests are getting more and more sophisticated, and so they trail you. We need something that just deals with the activity factor. And I'm an economist. I don't know how it's going to happen, But that's going to be, we cannot allow workplaces to get away from being drug-free, but we want to make certain that they are not have impaired workers. Now more happy news. Let's talk about trade. If I talk about trade at the Thanksgiving dinner table, you know what they do? They tell me to shut up. Well, here's a cartoon that says it all. This comes from the days of H. Ross Perot. Here's a guy in a cantina. He says, I don't know what that'll happen. One minute I'm at work in Flint, Michigan, and then there's this giant sucking sound, and suddenly here I am in Mexico. Well, this guy doesn't have a job in Flint anymore. They kind of closed Flint, or large parts of it. But if we go and deal with trade in a ham-fisted way that panders to the progressives or panders to those that are in pain, we'll kill ourselves. Because if we just look at the trade deficit, this is the trade deficit just in goods, the United States imports $2.3 trillion worth of goods. That's what we've been debating about politically. We don't talk about the $1.5 trillion of goods that we export. And with the growth of Marcellus Shale, and as the plastics industry starts moving more and more into eastern Ohio and reinforces the manufacturing base that goes from York, Pennsylvania to Milwaukee, we're going to be shipping out more and more of those goods. Realize that we have a very highly independent region. Because of time, I'm not going to give you a quiz, but this is an eye chart. So if you can read it, you're good. I ask you to look at your leisure. This is the one-page fact sheet on Ohio's exports. It shows that Ohio's exports in real value have been growing throughout. Our top 10 markets from Ohio are Canada and Mexico. By far, Canada, we ship out $20 billion worth of products. In Mexico, we export another $6.5 billion worth of products. In China, the state of Ohio ships out $3.3 billion worth of products. We are in an international trade state, and if we have a ham-fisted, stupid discussion about trade that purely reacts and panders to pain, we'll make it worse. Our top 10 exports, industrial machinery, vehicles and parts, aircrafts and parts, and everything in agricultural products. So in each of those, I've listed this work. The Ohio Development Services Agency has done a great job in keeping track of this stuff. The other thing that's happened and now hurts us is whenever the value of the dollar goes up, remember, people think strong dollar, strong America? Strong dollar, weak Ohio, because of our dependence on trade. And what's happened is since July 1 of 2014, the value of the dollar has gone up 25% against our major trading currencies. So that means that it's going to be tougher to produce here versus other platforms. And beginning in May of 2016, with the demonization of Mexico, the peso has fallen by almost 60%, making Mexico a much cheaper place to produce than it was before we demonized that country. When it comes to Mexico, realize that when the Mexican economy craters, that's when illegal immigration increases. We have a very strong vested interest in a strong, honest Mexican economy, but we also want them to obey the equivalent of environmental rules while they're doing it. So we need an adult conversation, because Ohio, while it's granted that we have a lot of labor-intense goods aren't made here anymore, they will not be made here ever again. The reason is, when I gave a lecture in Guangzhou, China about a year ago, I had 500 Chinese manufacturers sitting in the room scared stiff. What were they afraid of? They're afraid of the United States. Because we're increasingly, our competitiveness in sophisticated manufacturing was increasing by leaps and bounds. They were petrified of Vietnam and Thailand, which was beating them on labor cost. Because what's happening in China for all those billions of people? Because of Mao's one-child policy, they have very small numbers of people entering the labor force. And that dynamic is really changing. So now let's look at the policy puzzle around manufacturing and jobs. I had to pull out another old-fashioned cartoon of mine. I loved it. Two working stiffs go out there. One looks in the distance and says, there it is again. The invisible hand of the marketplace is giving us the finger. That's kind of what Ohio feels like when we go into victim mode. We can't afford to go into victim mode. Understand that manufacturing and manufacturing jobs are changing. They're changing drastically. And what's going on is just think about who are the largest manufacturing nations in the globe. China is first at almost $3 trillion. Second is the United States at $2.1 trillion. If I ask this test to anybody, they don't think we're in the top 10. Japan, almost a trillion. Germany, there's Mexico. The place is the great sucking sound that causes all these problems for our manufacturing economy is at $400 billion. The other thing that is true when you put together the look at the major trading blocks, the single largest trading bloc in the globe is NAFTA with $22 trillion worth of product. So that increasingly what's happening with manufacturing is you're locating your plants and competing by where you are in trading blocks. China alone is $20 trillion. The European Union is just a little bit smaller. This is before Britain bails at $19 trillion, but it doesn't include Switzerland. The United States on its own is $18 trillion. So we are a manufacturing powerhouse. And what we know and what we've seen is that Deloitte and BCG have looked forward 10 years and they have said that the United States is going to be the most competitive place to produce starting in 2020. The reason is it's the fifth industrial revolution. This is the digital factory. This is the digital factory being connected where the machines on the floor are connected to the ERP that runs the company that is connected to their customers' information data system. This is the cyber physical system, and we are going to a whole new generation of lean. Every time a major new technology gets harnessed into manufacturing systems, that's what delineates each of these regions, productivity goes up, value of product goes up, and employment may go up, but it's not going to go up by as much because of the way the machines work. So here's the fact that the migration to Industry 5.0 has already begun. The green line is total employment in manufacturing. Looks like a shooty shoe. Some of that went into temp work, maybe about 20%, but not all of it. And that's dropped way down. But look at that red line. That red line is the real value of output per worker, skyrocketing. And then the value of real output is increased real output per worker. That shows what's going on with the petrochemical industry. The point I want to make is that productivity growth in manufacturing now is low. It went through a big upturn when the auto industry came back. It's kind of leveled out. When Industry 5.0 comes around and those machines have been only on the market for 18 months, you're going to see productivity to go up drastically again. The bright spot for Ohio is that next boost in productivity coupled with the development of the Utica or Marcellus shale industries. Here's gross state product by sector for Ohio. Manufacturing, $110 billion of gross state product. The green bars tend to be industries that are more population serving. The red bars are those that are the economic base that support the population. Finance and insurance comes next at $50 billion. Professional scientific and technical service, $30 billion. Transportation, warehousing, information, so that's kind of the Columbus Amazon sector, I guess. Add them together, you're at about $40 billion. So manufacturing's health is absolutely critical to our own future. Mark, how am I doing on time?
We're getting pretty close to being finished.
All right, so I will end with this and leave you future puzzles to go for. So if we look at manufacturing here, the green line, the map in green is total manufacturing employment in each county. You'll notice it seems to follow highway patterns, but it's the industry that ties the state together. The blue map shows you the share of manufacturing in your workforce, and your intensity and specialization. You'll see that it's a series of rural counties that are most dependent on manufacturing. This is not urban versus rural. When it comes to major business investment, nearly half of all major business investment in the state's been manufacturing. More than $3.2 billion in new investment from 2013 to 15 came from manufacturing, accounted for 11,000 new jobs, 10 million square feet of new construction, and more than one-third of the manufacturing products are expansions made by firms that are already in Ohio. But the number of jobs per dollar of investment is dropping like a rock. And that's because of capitalization. So map of where all these projects are. So let's just think about the big issues here. We've talked about the demographic change. Replacing the boomers is a huge challenge. Industry 5.0 means that there's going to be less work for the unskilled and semi-skilled manufacturing. We now have a labor shortage for the engineering technologist and the mechatronic specialists, those know mechanical and electronics, to keep the lines going. We're on the brink of this new wave of productivity and a new round of shop floor lean. And here's the important point. Our manufacturing workforce system is fundamentally broken. It's not the fault of state policy. It's not the fault of workers. It is the fact that we have shed 7 million manufacturing jobs in the United States for the past, since 1979, and the manufacturers haven't had to hire anybody. Now, they've got a donut hole in the workforce. All their knowledge that's in their companies is aging and aging out. The new kids are new kids, and no one's in the middle. It's broken, the workforce system is broken in ways that just won't immediately respond to wage pressures. The enemy are guidance counselors and parents, because they think being a lawyer is much more secure than being a welder. They're wrong, by the way. The disruption in the private sector's ability to train started in the late 1990s. We have two generations of private business leaders that haven't had to train people in this industry. They forgot how. And during the Great Recession, those companies that had three HR people in them, they threw every expense over to stay alive, they're down to one HR person. Those that had two HR people are down to one, and those that are having one are saying, please, but don't work overtime. That's where the training capacity is. We have to work private sector and public sector to bring it together. And we have to figure out how to immediately respond to traditional skilled positions, but they take 2 to 4 years to train. So at this point, because of time, I'll leave it here, and I'm happy to talk to any of you at any time. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to serve the legislature, and together, following the words of Jim Rhodes, jobs and progress, we'll get it done. Thank you very much.